Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Friday, September 2nd, and today Dylan Byers joins me to talk about the fallout from CNN firing media anchor Brian Stelter. Who on the talent roster might be next? And Dylan also shares his insight on why the Washington Post is facing some financial struggles, even as their rival, the New York Times, surges. And later on, will Trump go to jail? Executive editor Ben Landy and Puck's legal expert Eric Gardner discuss the latest twists in the FBI's investigation into Trump's hoarding of classified and top-secret materials at Mar-a-Lago. Can the Justice Department prove he committed a crime? And even if they did, would Merrick Garland have the stones to charge him? We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Happy Friday, everybody. Hope you're getting ready for a fun holiday weekend, celebrating the American labor movement, of course. I'm joined today by Dylan Byers for a little bit of media dish. How you doing, Dylan?
I'm doing great. I myself am just back from vacation, and I'm feeling rested and ready to get back into the grind.
Nice. Yeah, it definitely feels like, I know this always happens, in D.C., when I was in D.C., there was the myth that like news doesn't happen in August. Like news does happen in August, but it feels like
Yes. Very
specifically this last week of August is slow times in whatever industry you're in. So I'm glad you're getting ready to get back into it. Hey, you have a piece out that just dropped earlier in the week about Brian Stelter's firing from CNN. The headline, If you get Dylan's newsletter in your email, the headline was Helter Stelter. We, you know, John and I, who typically steal your reporting for our Media Monday segments, have chewed this over a bit. But can you just like pull back the curtain a little bit on what does this say about Chris Licht and CNN's next steps? Is someone else on the chopping block next in the talent roster? And what does this move signal about the next steps there?
Yeah, here's what I would say. I think that Stelter being ousted from CNN was not altogether surprising, I think, even to him. I don't think he necessarily thought he was going to be fired, but I think when it happened, I think he saw the logic, which is Chris Licht moves in under with a mandate from David Zaslav and John Malone to basically, John Malone, the powerful shareholder who we talk about often here at Puck, to depolarize, departisan, detoxify CNN. And one reason Stelter is such an obvious target for that is that part of trying to establish CNN's reputation as a nonpartisan, straight down the middle news organization that is accessible to everyone is that your reputation often isn't defined solely by you. It is oftentimes defined by your critics. And so Say what you will, whether you are a fan of Brian Stelter's show or not, whether you found him to be holding people's feet to the fire in a very great way, or whether you thought he was sort of sanctimonious and alarmist, like whatever you may think, he, along with a handful of other CNN personalities, had put himself squarely in the crosshairs of Fox News, the right-wing media, right-wing online digital media. And so it becomes, in a way, untenable to keep him at the network and also make the claim that you are eschewing the sort of former anti-Trump, anti-Fox News opinionation machine, if you keep around the guy who literally wrote the book about how terrible it was that Trump and Fox News were in bed together. And so I think he's sort of the obvious candidate in that regard. I think that if you look at him being put up as sort of, he has even floated this idea when he talks to people about why he was fired. He says, you know, I'm not really sure, but this is what people who have talked to him have told me, but I, you know, maybe I'm the sacrificial lamb. And if you wonder, okay, who are the other sacrificial lambs? I think you just ask yourself the same question. Who has built their reputation or built their own personal brand by being a sort of staunch anti-Trump, anti-right-wing media champion of the free press and truth and civility? And who is in the crosshairs of Fox News? So I think you look at the Jim Acostas, you look at the Breonna Keelers, and you think, well, maybe, certainly the conversation inside CNN right now among people I've talked to is that those are the people who might be next to go.
What about Don Lemon?
Yeah, so a lot of people have been wondering if Don Lemon, I think the answer to that is no. I think that Don Lemon is actually a couple things. One, I think he's a valuable on-air talent. Some people don't like him, but it turns out he meets the bar for being good on television in prime time, and not a lot of people meet that bar. I think he is capable of doing one thing in the Zucker administration and then doing a very different thing in the Chris Licht administration. I also, just to speak in terms of very clear realpolitik, because that's the way these people think, media executives, is that it's not a great look to cancel the only gay black anchor in primetime. I don't think that would be great for the reputation of CNN. And look, he's a very capable on-air person, whether you like him or not. He's good at his job. He knows how to do that job. He can take breaking news on the fly. He can read from a teleprompter. He's charismatic and good looking. I think he's fine. I think he'll probably be a part of Chris Licht's CNN in a new iteration from what he was as a part of Jeff Zucker's CNN. But those other people, I think, are much more vulnerable. But then I think, you know, the real question here is, at a certain point, what's happening, which I write about in the piece, is Chris Licht so far has just been sort of trying to, like, nip around the edges in order to de-Zuckerfy CNN. And at a certain point, he's actually, you know, getting rid of the breaking news banner, having more Republicans on, toning down the volume and the tone of the rhetoric. At a certain point, he will be judged for the decision, the proactive decisions he actually makes that are putting his own stamp on the network. And I think we're going to see that when he finally gets around to revamping the morning show and figuring out what he's doing in prime time at 9 p.m., I think that will ultimately be the test of his legacy. But we are still living through this very sort of weird, painful period where he's trying to almost like virtue signal to America and to his bosses to prove that he's like fulfilling the mandate of moving CNN's reputation back toward that down the middle, just the facts, ma'am, journalism that his bosses have called for from the get-go.
So one thing you write about, too, is John Malone. Malone is, what's his official title as it relates to CNN?
So he is one of 13 board members at Warner Brothers Discovery.
Right. Okay.
But with equal voting power, but we should just say very quickly, he is a mentor to David Zaslav, someone who David Zaslav looks up to and emulates and has real influence and power over that company. And that's not to say that David Zaslav doesn't, he certainly does, but I think that David Zaslav and John Malone sort of are of one mind on a lot of things, I would say.
Yeah, I mentioned Malone because after Brian was removed from the network, there were sort of like resistance types on Twitter who were, you know, lamenting how this is bad for democracy and, you know, Reliable Sources is an essential show for democracy. Some of that was pretty overheated.
I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think democracy will live or die based off of a Sunday CNN show.
I know. But like there was this one theory, I saw it on several Twitter accounts, that like John Malone was the like unseen puppet master here, and he told people at Chris Licht to get rid of Brian Stelter. And like, I kind of chuckled at that, in part because of your reporting, which goes back to last fall on this stuff. But John Malone was public. I believe he was on CNBC or Fox Business last September saying, you know, I want CNN to get back to the basics of journalism and calling balls and strikes, et cetera. And so, you know, you write this in the piece, he was already just public about signaling where he wanted this network to go. And so that's probably where Licht was coming from. Like, he didn't need John Malone to pick up the phone and be like, you need to fire Brian Stelter and Jim Acosta. He was already out there public with this stuff, and Licht came in with that mandate, and here we are.
There's this weird conspiratorial thinking happening at CNN in some corners of CNN right now, which is somewhat ironic for a network that has dedicated so much of the last 6 or 7 years to trying to debunk conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. like you say, like the invisible hand of John Malone, and he's picking, you know, he's calling all the shots and pulling all the strings. It's not unseen. There is no conspiracy. It's out there publicly. John Malone went out on CNBC. He's extremely influential. Anyone who knows that company understands his influence over David. I don't mean that in a nefarious way, but he understands that the two guys are sort of a mind, and said that he wanted CNN to get back to doing journalism, get away from the sort of like liberal opinionation, anti-Trump thing. And it's all there. I mean, it's just, he just laid it out, and it's all, you could sort of see it coming before the merger even closed. And before Warner Brothers Discovery took over CNN. So it's not, there's nothing unseen here at play. I mean, maybe there was a phone call that I don't know about yet, and maybe one day I'll be able to report on that, but it's all sort of there. You don't need a phone call. David Zaslav, John Malone, Chris Licht are all of the same mind, which has been articulated by Malone, which is that CNN became way too alarmist and sanctimonious and polarizing in going after Trump, in going after Fox News, in touting itself as sort of like the last bulwark that was holding up, you know, democracy. That's not what the new ownership wants it to be. It wants it to be that traditional old-fashioned, here's what happened today in London, here's what happened today in Baghdad, here's what's happening in Washington, and we'll have political debate and we'll have political panels, but we're going to represent the broad swath of viewpoints. And so, again, the people who have been standing up there for the last 6 or 7 years and making a name for themselves by being warriors on behalf of democracy or journalism or whatever, most of those people probably don't have a future at the network.
That's right. You know, a study came out earlier this week from the Associated Press and the American Press Institute and they basically surveyed millennials and Gen Z, like the age group between like 16 and 40. I would quibble with that demographic. I feel like a 40-year-old and a 16-year-old don't have a lot in common, but they basically asked how basically people under 40 view the news media, how they engage with it. And far and away, the number one expectation for what Americans want from news is to keep it straight down the middle and just deliver facts and try to be fair. And even, I know this will blow some minds on the left, to be fair to both sides.
Right.
And to stop, using news as entertainment or to promote conflict or to drive up ratings. I mean, there's a Twitter conversation that suggests the press, the mainstream press, their job is to call out injustice and call out bad actors, et cetera. I think consumers, on the other hand, you know, this is why local news always rises to the top of the most trusted news sources. You know, it's just, here are the facts. Here's the weather. Here's the sports. They don't want the opinion. They don't want the editorializing. We'll see what people over the age of 40 say about that, but I have a sense that it's pretty similar. Dylan, I want to change topics real quick to away from television and to print/digital. The New York Times, Ben Mullen and Katie Robertson reported this week that the Washington Post is facing some business struggles. They write that the organization is on track to lose money in 2022 after years of profitability. The digital ad revenue generated by the Post fell to roughly $70 million during the first half of the year, which is 15% lower than the first half of 2021. Fred Ryan, the CEO and publisher, has suggested cutting about 100 jobs. You know, the Post has fewer than 3 million paying digital subscribers right now, which is less than last year. Why is the Washington Post struggling here on the business side while the New York Times is just surging in terms of subscribers and products? You know, both of these places have incredible reporters. The Post has money thanks to Jeff Bezos. What's the difference between the two places? Because they certainly see themselves as rivals.
So during the Trump years, the Post and the Times essentially experienced the same thing, which a lot of media organizations, The Atlantic, New Yorker, CNN, whatever, everyone. The Trump bump. And if you actually look at the rate of growth at both the New York Times and the Washington Post, it was roughly equivalent. In fact, I think the rate of growth, subscriber growth at the Washington Post might have even been marginally higher. the difference between those two companies is that while they had that moment and while they were acquiring subscribers, the New York Times, largely due to the sort of savvy of their previous CEO and their current CEO, they capitalized on the moment and found all sorts of ways to basically pivot the New York Times from being a newspaper or a news website into being a sort of lifestyle brand that gave mm-hmm. them everything. Crossword games and word games and Wordle and cooking apps and the daily podcast and all these sort of things that I think about in terms of tote bags. Like, what is it that's going to make a person go from just being a subscriber to being someone who wants to carry around the tote bag, right? New York Times became a way that you sort of identified yourself. And oftentimes, on a day-to-day level, you might read one or two stories on the Times website, but you were using the cooking app nightly. You were playing Wordle daily. You were listening to the Daily. The Washington Post doesn't have any equivalent to this. They just didn't do it. They may have tried here and there in fits and starts, but they didn't capitalize on the moment in the same way. And so after Trump went away and after the Trump bump went away, the reasons to either subscribe to the Washington Post or keep your subscription to the Washington Post weren't as readily apparent, despite all of the good journalism that happens there. And I think, honestly, I don't know if despite... Let's look at the organization. You've got Jeff Bezos at the top, who's also still very involved in Amazon and is jet setting around the world and is mm-hmm. trying to go to space and probably has his head in 1,000 other things. You have Fred Ryan, who is a very smart guy, but is not necessarily a sort of very ambitious cutthroat media CEO. He is some, mm-hmm. you know, he was Reagan's chief of staff. He still has a job sort of running the Reagan Foundation. So he's sort of a Washington player. He's not necessarily like a globally minded, aggressive media CEO. And so maybe that's where the disconnect happened. But for whatever reason, they didn't seize the moment that they should have seized. And by the way, like, that moment may not come again. Now, the benefit that they have is that they still have Jeff Bezos as their owner, and he may decide to, you know, flood a bunch of money into sort of playing catch up with the New York Times or not. But the most obvious chance they had to go toe to toe with the New York Times has come and gone.
So, and I just want to stress, this isn't to suggest the Washington Post is in financial trouble. I mean, like, as far as news organizations go, they're doing very well.
Fine.
They're fine. They have incredible reporters, not just in Washington, but around the country and, you know, around the world. I think Fred Ryan wants to expand that. But yeah, I mean, it's you don't see people walking around with Washington Post tote bags. You do see people walking around with New York Times tote bags.
Right.
You know, maybe this is an opportunity for the Post to bring back my favorite slogan of all time. If you don't get it, you don't get it. That's my recommendation to the Washington Post. That's an old pre-Bezos marketing tag. Dylan, thanks so much, man, and glad to have you back from vacation.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up, Ben and Eric ask the question, will Donald Trump end up behind bars?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast. Selling a little or a lot?
Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Welcome back. I'm Ben Landy, here with Eric Gardner, our resident legal expert at Puck. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to bring you on to talk about the latest developments in the Trump FBI saga. I don't think there's any listeners out there who have not been following this case, but, you know, in short, the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago last month. They were looking for a large number of classified and top secret materials that Trump absconded with when he left the White House, which he was not allowed to do, and then apparently resisted multiple attempts by the Department of Justice to get them back. There's still some uncertainty about all the details here, and Trump's people have been claiming that he had the rights to these documents and he made good faith efforts to return them. But the DOJ just fired back on Tuesday saying, in essence, no, you didn't. And here's 36 pages of a legal filing to show exactly how damning this case could be. Lawyers like to talk about bad facts in a case. What are the bad facts here for Trump?
Yeah, well, let's start at what Trump is trying to do right here. He really can't do that much at all. What I see really what he's trying to do in court right now is performative, to kind of like play to the base and show that he's, you know, doing something strong against the DOJ. But what he's technically attempting is to get a judge that he himself appointed to look at what was collected and to see if anything was privileged, whether anything is attorney-client privilege or executive privilege, and, you know, stuff that the Justice Department really can't keep and use in court. That's it. And really, there's no real slowing this down. So I even if he supposedly wins this motion, it's not going to really do much for him. It's not going to go into the legitimacy of the search. It's not going to stop Trump from getting prosecuted. It's not going to do any of those sorts of things. It's just going to be, you know, just a little, you know, tiny impediment and not that much in itself. So Trump likes to use the courts. And so he had his lawyers, you know, file this motion. And really what it did was it gave the Justice Department an opportunity to respond, and respond they did. And, you know, they detailed some more things that we didn't know. And probably most importantly, they told us that they believe that Trump and, you know, his associates have likely tried to conceal evidence. And, you know, to the layperson, that really means that they believe that they could have an obstruction of justice charge against the president. And that's no small thing. You know, they laid out, you know, some of the evidence, and, you know, they even put a photograph of classified filings. It just looks very bad for Trump.
Could Trump's own lawyers be in any kind of legal jeopardy? I mean, allegedly one or two of them signed some kind of document attesting to the fact that they had searched Mar-a-Lago for these documents and returned as many as the government was asking for. Apparently, that was not the case.
Yeah, and it's one of the most incredible facts here. You know, of course, this lawyer created just a little bit of wiggle room because in the declaration, it was said that, you know, they relied on Donald Trump and all that. So, you know, perhaps there's some room in the future to wiggle out of this. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible that a lawyer would attest to the fact that a reasonable search was made and these documents were returned. And here we are, you know, months later, and, you know, we see lots of classified documents, you know, documents that were had the markings of top secret. So clearly that wasn't the case. And yeah, this lawyer is going to have to, you know, answer for what happened. I think that the Justice Department will certainly be interested in that. Whether or not they charge Trump, they'll probably look at this lawyer too and to figure out what role this lawyer played in potentially hiding evidence and obstructing justice.
Right. That's the big question is, what does this investigation actually lead to? And I want to read to you, this is the explanation from James Comey when he announced why there were not going to be charges against Clinton for her use of a private email server. Obviously, some parallels here with this case, a little bit different. But and this is the quote from him. He said, "Looking back at our investigations into mishandling or removal of classified information, we cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts. All the cases prosecuted involved some combination of clearly intentional and willful mishandling of classified information or vast quantities of materials exposed in such a way as to support an inference of intentional misconduct or indications of disloyalty to the United States or efforts to obstruct justice. We do not see those things here." Now, I go back and read that list. It seems like three of those four things do apply to Trump in this case. We don't know about indications of disloyalty per se, but everything else, I mean, willful mishandling, efforts to obstruct justice, that all seems like it's right here in plain view.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's pretty clear that the Justice Department could bring a case. But, you know, honestly, the factors aren't just whether a crime has been committed. The Justice Department and prosecutors, you know, take a look at other factors besides whether a crime has been committed. Number one, can they prove this crime beyond a reasonable doubt? You know, can they get a conviction for it? And two, and perhaps even most important, is whether this is going to be good for the country or not. The prosecutors have a wide degree of discretion here. They could conclude that this is just too controversial. Already they've sent signals that they aren't prepared to do anything until the midterm elections, which is a little bit telling. So I'm not sure whether it is going to actually be any criminal charges filed. There very well could be. But if there aren't, I'm not going to be surprised, because it's clear to me that they've investigated Trump for other things in the past and come to the conclusion that, you know, perhaps he did things. But, you know, we're going to err on the side of utmost caution here. And I think, you know, for better or worse, Trump is going to get that same degree of caution in this instance. But he's certainly provoking the Justice Department here. And, you know, the Justice Department, as we learned this week, believes that there were efforts to conceal obstruction. So I think that's definitely material.
Yeah. So for what it's worth, you can still run for president if you've been charged with a crime. You can still run for president if you've been convicted of a crime. Although, as far as I know, you cannot run for president if you were actually in prison. Although I don't know if that's a matter of law or just logistics.
Probably logistics, because I think there have been people who have run for office from jail. There are certain crimes, though, that would disqualify him. Maybe not for these crimes, although espionage, the mundane crime of espionage, could come close. But he's also being investigated in other areas, including in Georgia. And, you know, if he participated in an insurrection, that might, come very close to disqualifying from office. But, you know, it's definitely a, you know, fluid situation, and it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the next few months, especially after the election, when, you know, a lot of the prosecutors will feel a much freer hand to move.
All right, let me push you to make a prediction at the end here. Do you think the DOJ will bring charges? Do you think he would be convicted? And if he was convicted, do you think Trump would ever serve time?
I honestly do not know whether he is going to be charged or not, but if you're going to force me to make a prediction, I would say no, he will not be charged. That said, if he is charged, I do think he will be convicted. And if he is convicted, I do think that he will face jail time. So there you go.
All right, you heard it here first. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, and Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13.